Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In 1996, President Bill Clinton signed welfare reform legislation that sent 9 million women and children off the welfare rolls. Jason DePaul watched them go and for 7 years has followed them. The New York Times poverty reporter traced the stories of three former welfare mothers in Milwaukee, the nation's unofficial capital of welfare reform. He traced the intimate geography of their lives at work, their relationships, their dreams, their lives without welfare. Tonight on Point, Jason DePaul and intimate stories of life after welfare reform. But first tonight, we turn to Iraq, where two of the three building contractors kidnapped last Thursday in Baghdad have been beheaded, and a pair of female Iraqi scientists in American custody have emerged as key bargaining chips. Today, Iraqi and American officials disagreed over whether or not to give a green light to the release of the prisoners. One of them, the so-called Dr. Germ. This afternoon, an Islamic website posted a new video of the third hostage. The video shows British captive Kenneth Bigley weeping and pleading for his life. Rod Nordland is Baghdad bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. I asked him about the standoff and the day's tension between Iraqi and American officials.
The Iraqi government very kind of hurriedly pushed through a plan to release these two women, the last two women that are being held in custody, Dr. Germ and Dr. Anthrax. And the U.S. immediately said they would not release them. That raises the question of whether the Iraqis indeed do have the sovereignty that they promised, because those prisoners are supposed to be held by the Americans on behalf of the Iraqis. It also, of course, showed the hostage takers they could get some gain from what they did. And in the meantime, two Americans have been killed in any case.
The kidnappers have asked for the release of all female prisoners. I want to get this straight. Does that boil down to just two women, and who are they exactly?
The Americans say there are only two women prisoners in their custody. These two Iraqi scientists, who are popularly known as Dr. Germ and Dr. Anthrax, who ran various weapons of mass destruction programs under Saddam. And they've been held since early in the war, and the U.S. considers them high-value security detainees in a class with Saddam. Nonetheless, technically, Saddam and all those other prisoners are in Iraqi custody now, just being held by the Americans because they have the facilities to hold them. And they have said that the Iraqis have sovereignty. Now, the Iraqis fairly quickly ordered them released, and then it looks like they've gone back on that under U.S. pressure.
Is there pressure from London, from the U.K., to do one thing or another? It's their guy, Kenneth Bigley, who, as far as we know, remains alive and under the threat of beheading.
The Brits have taken the same position that the American government has, which is that if you give in to terrorists, it only encourages them to take other hostages. They've been fairly quiet about it, but they've made no moves toward trying to accommodate the hostage takers.
And who are the hostage takers believed to be at this point? Is it Musab al-Zarqawi? Is that confirmed? What's known about who's been holding and killing these men?
Apparently it is Zarqawi. The videotapes that have been released are in the same style as his earlier ones, the same kind of MO, the same method of killing their captives. And the CIA has confirmed now that, at least in the one video that was released of the first hostage being killed, Jack Armstrong, that indeed the voice print of the person talking and the person who beheaded him was actually Zarqawi.
Then how are authorities in Iraq interpreting this demand for the release of these two women involved in germ and anthrax weapons of mass destruction research, at least, I guess, is the allegation? How is that being interpreted? Do they want to bring them into their ranks, or does it have a symbolic import of some kind?
Well, it's quite muddled up because apparently the Zarqawi people are operating under the impression or at least trying to appear that they believe that there's a large number of Iraqi women in custody. That isn't the case any longer, and I think that's true. There have been press visits recently to Abu Ghraib prison where the Americans hold Iraqis, and there are no longer any Iraqi women prisoners there. There were previously, and it's kind of a cynical move on the terrorist part. They know this is a very sensitive issue with Iraqis. You know, after the prison abuse scandals came out at Abu Ghraib, there were a lot of stories that women were being abused too. And although there's never been any evidence of that, a lot of Iraqis believe that as a kind of an article of faith. So they're playing into that popular mood and trying to take advantage of it.
What about the two female Iraqi scientists in question? Is anything known about their status or thinking now? Have they recanted? Are they believed to be continuing threats? Or do they just want to go off and do biology research at a university in Iraq?
Well, I don't think they're considered continuing threats. It's pretty clear now that Saddam abandoned his weapons of mass destruction programs. And although it is clear that these scientists both worked on those programs in the past, there's no evidence that they were any time recently. So, yes, they probably could have released them. And I think the Iraqis felt that, given that, it wasn't an important issue to continue holding them, and that's something they could give up. The Americans feel very strongly that's only going to encourage further hostage taking.
The hostage takers have become much more bold in recent weeks and even days, Rod Nordland. What's the sense around Baghdad and the country now about everyone's vulnerability? Is anyone safe in Baghdad?
Well, to some degree now, and people are very concerned about it. We're basically in a lockdown situation. Almost all foreigners are pretty much confined to their quarters, and a lot of them have been leaving their quarters if they don't feel they're safe enough and taking refuge in hotels and even leaving the country. So it's had a very big effect, especially when you see how boldly they carried out this operation. They picked these guys up in Mansour last week, and after they executed Armstrong, they dumped his body off in Mansour as well, in the same neighborhood of the city, within blocks of the place that they picked him up, leading to the supposition that they perhaps even videotaped and killed him in the same neighborhood.
And this is a quite upscale neighborhood of Baghdad.
Yeah, with lots of embassy residences and official residences and so on, and a lot of prominent Iraqis, you know, very heavy presence of security forces, and yet they're operating right in the midst of that.
And, Rod, what do you know at this point about the remains of Eugene Armstrong and Jack Hensley, the two Americans who have been beheaded? Are they on their way back to the United States?
I'm not sure if they're physically on the way back. The process is underway. They've found two bodies. I think one has been positively identified. The other one, they're still working on identification. So I imagine fairly soon they would be repatriated.
Rod Nordland, be safe, and thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Rod Nordland is Baghdad bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with me from Baghdad. In 1992, during his first run for president, Bill Clinton vowed to put an end to welfare as we know it. 4 years later, Congress put that promise into law. 9 million women and children across the country came off the welfare rolls. Success, by the numbers, was staggering. In Milwaukee, where Wisconsin's state-level efforts drove change, the number of welfare recipients dropped by 93%. But what that success translates into for individuals is a complex story. For 7 years, veteran poverty reporter for the New York Times, Jason DeParle, traced the experiences of three women, Angie, Opal, and Jewel, cousins who left welfare. He tracked their struggles to find work, negotiate child care, and maintain tenuous relationships with their children's fathers. He witnessed their victories and their failures. Tonight he shares their stories. This hour, On Point, an up-close look at living poor in America after welfare reform. When welfare as we knew it ended, did you forget all about the millions who were still poor? Did you ever wonder how they managed? Were they you? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Baltimore is Jason DeParle, senior writer for the New York Times. He wrote extensively about poverty for the New York Times Magazine throughout the 1990s. His new book is American Dream, Three Women, Ten Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. Good evening and welcome, Jason DeParle.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us, and what a terrific book. It is such an intimate look. You know, welfare and poverty can be intimidating, but you've gotten in with so much, so close to these lives, Jason DeParle, that it really brings it to life. You've been covering poverty for a long time. Did you know when you began to track Angie and Opal and Jewel exactly what you were up to here? What was your plan?
Fortunately, I didn't know what I was up to. It was one of those experiences, like having kids, where fortunately you don't know what you're jumping into. Because the journey was longer and filled with more twists and turns than I could have imagined.
Describe the moment and remind us for a minute what happened in 1996 when Bill Clinton made good on his promise to end welfare as we knew it, and it changed. What was the change, and what was the scale of its impact?
Clinton made a promise in 1992 that sort of got hijacked by Newt Gingrich and the Republican Revolution. It was sold as the same pledge that Clinton had made ending welfare, but it had a much different content. Clinton had talked about an expansion of services where the Gingrich solution in the end was just to turn control back over to the states. So it was really the deregulation of welfare as much as it was the ending of welfare. It went back to the states with new autonomy to do whatever they wanted. And most of them imposed tough new work rules and time limits.
So, and of course, Wisconsin was a leader in that effort. If you were on welfare in the mid-90s in Wisconsin when these changes took place, what happened? How did it look? What were the official changes? What was required suddenly?
I went to Milwaukee because Milwaukee did something even before, with permission from the federal government, even before the new law passed.
Right.
And that's it. It became the first city in the country to impose a work requirement. In order to get your welfare benefits, welfare recipients had to take a community service job. They had to work in exchange for them. And what happened there was remarkable. Tens of thousands of women who we didn't think were able to work said, if I have to work for welfare, I'll just go off and find my own job. And that's certainly what happened with Angie and Jewel. Angie had been on the rolls for 12 years, had no high school education, and within 6 months she'd gone off and found her own job. The welfare population, by and large, was much more employable than anyone had anticipated.
And what you've done here is track exactly how their lives unfolded, these three women, as they moved into this new era, and we want to get the details of that, but I guess first, I mean, just you've got a family tree in here that brings us up to the present, where Jewel Reed and Angie Job and Opal Caples are our cousins, but the family tree goes all the way back to their slave ancestors. Describe something about the family. How did you hook up with them, and what was their background? How did it happen that they're cousins with such a history?
Well, I was in Jewel's house one day when her mother, Hattie Mae Crenshaw, came to visit, and I asked what seemed to be a rather innocent question. I said, "Oh, Miss Crenshaw, tell me about your background." And she looked at me and said, "Jason, I was born on Senator Jim Eastland's plantation in 1937 at a time when black peoples was just beginning to come out of slavery." And if that isn't a conversation stopper, I don't know what is. The name James Eastland will mean a lot to some of your listeners and not much to many. James Eastland was one of the last towering segregationists of the South. He was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee and used to walk around saying he had a pocket in his vest where civil rights bills went to die. So I was wondering, gee, was she really born on one of the last, you know, real white supremacists of the country? Was she really born on the Eastland Plantation? Was that family lore? Well, she was, and she still had the plantation was still in the Eastland family, and she still had relatives living there. In the summer of 2000, I went down and met her 85-year-old great-uncle, who moved there in 1927 and had lived his life as a sharecropper. So I got fascinated with the family history and was able to trace it back to a common ancestor who was brought into slavery as a child in the early 1840s.
And what you saw there is generation after generation, of course, not in welfare, starting in slavery, and working toward, well, you titled the book American Dream, but you came away not persuaded that they even dreamed this American dream.
Yeah, Tom, the importance of the family history, it's not just a kind of interesting artifact of the book, but I think it bears relevance for the welfare debate, which is it bears relevance in several ways. One, so many of the problems that we attributed to welfare, like out-of-wedlock childbearing, poverty, dependency, the problems of the underclass, black-on-black violence, substance abuse. These things were proliferating on the Eastland Plantation in the 30s and 20s and 30s and early 40s, long before there was welfare. You know, Newt Gingrich used to talk about 12-year-olds having babies.
Right.
Hattie Mae had one before there was welfare.
Welfare didn't whip that up. Jason DePaul, stand by. We're going to take a short break. We're talking tonight with Jason DePaul. He's author of the new book, American Dreams. You can join the conversation. Has poverty fallen off your screen since Bill Clinton vowed to end welfare as we know it? What do you hear in these stories? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight, or taking, I guess, an up-close look at living poor in America after welfare reform. My guest is New York Times reporter and author of the new book, American Dream, Jason DePaul. It's American Dream, 3 women, 10 kids, and a nation's drive to end welfare. You can join the conversation tonight. What's your question on life after welfare reform from a reporter who's been called the foremost, most preeminent reporter on poverty in America? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jason DePaul, you sort of track this between Washington and the streets of Milwaukee. Most of us know the bumper stickers and the slogans that came out around welfare reform. You've been close to it and seen the reality. Describe these 3 women to us and how it has played out in their lives.
The 3 women take on different roles in the book. One of the interesting things that happens is that when they're on welfare, they're 3 cousins. They're living together, literally together in adjacent apartments in Milwaukee. But as they leave welfare and their lives, as they get older, they move from their mid-20s to their mid-30s, they take on different interests. Angie gets very invested in her work, really does believe that she can get ahead by working and enjoys work and gets meaning from her work.
What kind of job did she pick up, Jason?
She became a nursing aide. Worked in an industry I hadn't thought about at all before I started working on the book. It's really hard work, Tom. One of the startling discoveries for me was that nursing aides get injured more often than coal miners.
Because they're carrying people, lifting, turning.
Exactly, from lifting and taking care of the patient. Yeah, lifting patients constantly. In the break room at the nursing home, they joke about the shooting pains down their back.
You can drop a load of coal. You really don't want to drop a patient.
One in four lives in poverty. 1 in 5 has no health insurance, even though they work in the healthcare industry. Mm-hmm. Yet for all that, Angie finds some meaning in it. She likes the patients. It taps a kind of creativity in her, an empathy. Human relatedness that I think other parts of her life don't. One of the hopes we'd had for putting people to work is that it would build some meaning for them. And that's the one place where I thought the law actually was successful in Angie's case. Now, there were other places where I didn't think it was successful.
Successful in plugging her into work and giving her a sense of meaning that came from that.
Exactly, yeah. She really liked it. There's a story that she tells about early on in her nursing career, she was taking care of a frightened, frail, elderly white woman who Angie bent down to take care of her, and the woman snapped, "Get your hands off me, you know what," and barked a racial epithet at her. Yeah, on the streets, Angie's fists would have been up, or her knife would have been out, or she'd have been ready to do battle. But
you describe her as a really pugnacious woman, not short
exactly.
But fierce.
Exactly. Yeah, and with me, too. And with this elderly woman, she laughed and said, "Well, the you know what is clinging you because you can't do it yourself, so you might as well just let me." And she sloughed it off. I mean, it brought out an empathy, a warmth, a caring in her that I think even her relationship with her kids didn't do. It was she was more patient with her patients than she was with her kids. So that was a good part of the story. I don't want to leave it just at that because there's more to say about the bad parts of the story.
But give us the top line on Jewel and Opal, the two cousins
Jewel
as well.
Jewel also leaves the roles and becomes a full-time steady worker. But for Jewel, work is just something she does. What she cares about is Ken. And Ken, for most of this time, is involved. Ken is the object of her romantic pursuit. Mm-hmm. And for most of this time, he has dual business lines. One is selling drugs and the other is selling sex. He's a pimp putting out hookers on the street, which doesn't diminish Jewel's ardor in the least. So she becomes, in the book, a sort of vehicle for writing about women's relation, men, women, the male-female relationships in these women's lives, the boyfriends, love. She really wants to have a baby with him. And for much of the narrative, it's a discouraging story. I mean, I keep thinking, oh, he goes to jail, and he spends 2 years in jail, and she's writing in these letters every other day, and I keep thinking she's pouring out her heart to this guy. It's obviously a lost cause. He's been in jail half his life, and then here's the most remarkable surprise in the whole book. He got out and went straight. He's been out for 4 years now. He works as a pizza delivery man in Milwaukee, gave up drug dealing, and you know, she won him over, and he changed his life. Never bet against Jewel. That was the lesson I took away from it.
So to some degree, you've got elements of success in those two stories. We'll come back and look more closely. How about Opal?
Opal was the woman I thought would be the biggest success. She's the only one of the three to have a high school degree. She had been married, which is usually a sign of greater, it's a predictor of greater economic success. She even had a semester of community college. What I didn't understand when I first met her is that she was secretly addicted to drugs. And Jewel and Angie didn't know that about her for a while either. But she just has a horrendous descent through the social services bureaucracy. She winds up homeless, pregnant, living in a crack house, and the Wisconsin welfare system essentially was buying the crack. They just kept sending her checks every month, not knowing anything of her condition.
What meaning does welfare or welfare reform have in a case like that?
Well, I can't say that her condition was caused by the law. I mean, she was a drug addict before the law passed. And she was addicted to drugs after the law passed. What I can say is that Wisconsin had a tremendous amount of money and could have done something to help her and other women. At this time, she was getting $32,000 a year from the federal government because the feds kept the payment levels at the old rates, even as these caseloads, as you said in your intro, went down 90%. So they were rolling in money, and there's stories of just tremendous waste. One of the agencies that was supposed to be helping Opal was instead spending welfare dollars on buying golf balls and golf tees with their corporate name emblazoned on them.
You know well, Jason DePaul, that since welfare reform passed, a lot of Americans, my sense is, sort of, wiped the brow and said, okay, we're finished with that. People are getting jobs, and now they're part of the big system, and that's behind us. Take these three stories and pull out of it the thread of what we ought to understand about welfare reform, for good and for ill.
Yeah, okay. The good is that, as Angie and Jewel's story shows, two out of three of the three of them were able to move into the full-time steady workforce. And these were, Angie had been on for 12 years, Jewel had been on for 8. They could work. There's tremendous resilience, resourcefulness, strength in them. They could go out and get jobs.
So the idea that they couldn't even hold down a job, that didn't play out here.
Daniel Patrick Moynihan, senator from New York, used to talk about them as about people on welfare as dependents, and he said to be dependent is to hang, as though they were inert. He said at one point, take welfare away, the children will be blown to the winds, as though these were passive objects swirling in the winds. They're not. They're survivors. They're tough. They're resourceful. They're resilient. They're creative. So that's some good news. I have two disappointments. One is that their work didn't translate into more economic progress for them.
What were they making? Were they still in poverty when they worked?
Well, poverty, they went from like just under the poverty line to just above the poverty line. It sort of depends on which period you take. Mm-hmm. The point, there's a great quote about that because in the poverty field, there's endless debate about how one should define
poverty.
Where
should the line be drawn? Yeah.
Exactly. And what do you include? And do you include taxes or not taxes? And how do you count housing assistance? All these sorts of things. So I thought Angie had the greatest line about it. She said, I ain't going to call me poor, but I am poor. That was her definition. She didn't want to be known as poor. She didn't want to think of herself as poor. But if you put it that way, yeah, I'm poor. I mean, it didn't. She could, on paper, you could make a case that she was 5 to 10% better off, but it was nothing she could notice. Even after she left the rolls, she'd become a successful worker. She was earning more than 85% of the people leaving the Wisconsin rolls. She lost her lights 3 years in a row.
Meaning her electricity bill wasn't.
Her electricity got shut off 3 years in a row, three times in 3 years. She lost her health insurance, and this was really startling to me, just how often she was short on food. I mean, this is a successful worker. This isn't. It's not shocking to me that there are people in America who run out of food, but it's somewhat disturbing and I think surprising, and ought to be disturbing to everyone, that someone who's performing better in the workplace than four out of five people leaving the roles is running out of food. I mean, she's a success, and she was running out of food.
Bill Clinton said he wanted to build a kind of a bridge, never mind the 21st century, but to dignity and hope, getting people into work. You described Jewel and Angie as survivors. Was it survivors or survival that was ennobled or powered by dignity and hope when they moved into these working capacities?
Well, I think for them, I think we have to disentangle two things that sometimes get lumped together. I think especially for Angie felt good about her work, there's no doubt. And to a lesser degree, even though Jewel didn't like to admit it as much, I think, you know, deep down inside she felt like, hey, I get up and go to work. You can't call me a welfare recipient anymore. So for them, yes. But what didn't translate, I think, is success for their kids. We had this idea that when mothers became working, when they went to work, they would become role models for
right.
their kids.
Yeah.
We put their kids on a new life trajectory. And that's really what we want to do, right? Okay, by the time Angie and Jewel are 30, their life, the choices have been made and dies have been cast. But we really want to get their kids on a different trajectory. And their kids, the fact that they were at work, if it meant anything to their kids, it meant that they were spending more time alone. And they were alone in kind of chaotic houses with in dangerous neighborhoods. There's a murder that takes place in Angie's house one day when she's away from work. There's fights with Angie's boyfriends. One of Angie's daughters gets pregnant while, you know, enters adolescence. They weren't – this notion that because a mother is working, her kids are going to be better off is a deeply intuitive and appealing one, and something we really want to believe. I don't disparage it. I'm just not sure it's supported by the evidence in the case of low-wage single mothers.
So when you look across that scene, where do you put these women and their families in relationship to the American dream? I mean, I guess that's the bottom line. That's what people hope that families post-welfare would get on some rung of.
I struggle to put myself in Angie's mind, in Angie's heart, and try to see the world as she saw it as a young woman. Why did she make the choices that she did? Why did her life get cast the way it did? At one point, I even pushed. I said, Angie, it's a big prosperous country out there. Okay, what's the matter? Why couldn't you get with it? Why didn't you achieve other things? And she kind of welled up and she looked at me and she said, did you think we came here here being Milwaukee? Because there was just so much opportunity for us, that we had such great jobs here in Milwaukee. There was something great waiting for us. We didn't come for that stuff. And what struck me was that it was the exact like mirror image of the immigrant language, and you know, the immigrants coming for something, some sense of opportunity. And I used to live – I spent a year living in a squatter camp in the Philippines 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I've stayed in touch with my host family there. The teenage daughter who's now 30 is a Filipino nurse, and I've been trying to help her come into the United States. So during the time I've been doing this reporting – I'm getting these periodic phone calls and emails from Rosalie Komodas in exile, really, in the Middle East on these contracts because she can't get a job in the Philippines, just about how she would give anything, literally, to come to the United States of America. So sure, there's problems with childcare, and sure, we're going through deindustrialization, but Rosalie from the other side of the globe has this sense of the American dream, and somehow it disappeared from Angie's life. That's a sad thing.
As close as she is to it, she can see it on television. She must feel that it's out there, but she doesn't feel that it was for her to reach out and grab.
You know, I never sensed any victimization from Angie. When you talk to her about her life goals, never like I was kept down because of this, that, or the other thing. But I never sensed any real aspiration either. Like, well, I really wanted to become an RN, but I didn't get there. What I really sensed was just alienation. That she had a profoundly alienated childhood, a terrible adolescence. Her father was an alcoholic. She withdrew into rebellion and into drugs and into a very seductive, destructive street culture. and was never able to fully climb her way back out of it.
We're looking at life after welfare reform on the streets of Milwaukee, it turns out, with Jason DeParle. He's author of the new book, American Dream. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Scott is calling from Canton, Massachusetts. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's nice to speak to you. I'm an attorney working with welfare recipients currently, and I felt like I had an obligation to call in.
Yeah, great. What do you see, Scott? What do you see out there?
Well, what I see is I do come from a left perspective, but I also come with the perspective of agreeing with the original way welfare reform came about, or the original reason for welfare reform, which is to get people off the rolls and into jobs that would, you know, sustain them through life.
Yeah.
But the reality of what I'm seeing here is it's become less about getting people, you know, off the rolls and into jobs that can sustain them, and more about just getting people off the rolls and just sort of letting them be. There's a sort of hostility, especially up here in Massachusetts, towards, I mean, I can't really speak for other states, but there's a real hostility between the welfare workers and their clients. There's a real communication disconnect, and you know, their work requirements are very harsh, and, you know, it becomes a lot about, you know, trying to rush the people out the door, you know, and some people who really want to work very, very, very badly, but they also don't really have the tools educationally, or, you know, they don't have basic things like transportation or child support, which would let them have that sort of freedom. And I believe your speaker this evening was also talking about the fact that, you know, even if they can find work, they can't find work that would allow them to, you know, both look at, they have families, look after their children, and also work. Oftentimes they end up working and the children are sort of left alone at home.
So you've got a front row seat, and it doesn't look good for there. Scott, our time is short before the break, so let me give it to Jason DeParle. But Jason, this seems to line up in part with what I hear you saying. And yet, on balance, I hear you open to the reform and saying there's good here, too.
Oh, there is. I started doing this reporting in the mid-'80s when everything was bad and getting worse. And some things did get a bit better. I mean, people did get jobs. Child care was expanded. Tax credits were brought in. There's no reason to feel – I view it as a good first step, a confidence-building measure that encourages us to do more, not to feel defeated.
But Scott's watching people being driven off the rolls without the tools to succeed, and I guess it's like making sausage. It's not always pretty to see firsthand. You must have seen.
Well, he's absolutely right. There's no doubt that caseload reduction itself became a paramount goal of in the implementation of the welfare bill. And in fact, it's written into the law. States got the equivalent of frequent flyer points for throwing people off the rolls. They had to meet certain federal standards for what percentage of their recipients were working. But if you threw someone off the – if you removed them, threw them off is a bit pejorative. If you got them off the rolls, it didn't matter whether they had gotten a $20-an-hour job, a $10-an-hour job, or no job at all. You met your federal participation rates.
And that's what everybody was aiming for. Jason DeParle, stand by. We've got to take a short break. My guest, Jason DeParle, senior writer for the New York Times, author of the new book, American Dream, 3 Women, 10 Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. What do you see in the world of life after welfare? Is the cycle of poverty being broken here? Is it settling in again in a different way? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're taking a close-up look tonight at living poor in America after welfare reform. My guest is Jason DePaul, author of the new book, American Dream. You can join the conversation. Has welfare reform brought hope and dignity? And what is America's obligation to its poor now? What's your assumption here, spoken or unspoken, that poverty is an individual character issue or a challenge for all of society? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Claire is calling from West Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Claire. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Good to have you.
We have a lot to say, so I'll try to keep it to some main points.
Let's hear it.
First of all, I'm in the welfare rights movement, and I want to say that it's a very active, broad movement. I publish a paper, Survival News, here in Boston, and we have about 10,000 issues that go out twice a year. And I just want to say that welfare really makes a difference. In the 18 years I've been in this activism, I've seen welfare make a difference in so many women's lives, with educational benefits that have been taken away and child care benefits. Women are lifted out of poverty and get out in the world and get jobs that are above poverty.
Is this a past tense discussion?
Pardon?
You're saying this is how it used to be? And what do you see after welfare reform?
Then welfare reform was named the Personal Responsibility Act, not for nothing. It's a blame-the-victim mentality. You ask the question, is, you know, welfare an individual problem or a social problem? Well, it's obviously, to me, it's part of our economic system that there has to be people in poverty so that you can match the lowest wage that someone would be more willing to take than actually go on the dole and take the shame of it. I'm a professor at a local college. I have a doctorate.
Yeah.
And I spent a small amount of time on welfare, and you know, I'm embarrassed to say that because there's so much stigma attached to it. But I think it's a tragedy that women have to go out and take care of other people's children for below poverty wages and leave their children unattended. And I think that to separate the welfare program from unemployment programs and Social Security, which people can receive with dignity when it's the same entitlement, is a tragedy, and to blame poor women with sick children who can't take jobs because they have to bring children to doctors is so uncharitable. And I just wonder what happened. You know, I think that when the middle-class housewife had to go to work and the family had to have two incomes to make it, then it posited, you know, welfare women staying home taking care of their children against women that had to go to work and get child care.
So if they're going to do it, then everybody's going to do it.
Then the sympathy went away. And in my classes, I would have a welfare woman, you know, next to a working class woman, next to a middle class woman, you know, and one was getting their mother's help with a child, and one was working and trying to get through school and pay babysitters. And they would look at the welfare mother and say, you know, you're getting something for nothing.
Not fair. Claire, we've got it. There's a lot of experience in your observations. I thank you for them. Jason DePaul, what do you hear? Claire's saying, to some extent, bring back the welfare benefits, but of course they're going the other way. Is there she looks at it as a kind of terrible gulf here in caring for Americans. You're describing something more nuanced, as I hear you.
I thought there was great promise in Clinton's formulation of opportunity and responsibility. I like the notion of bringing them both together because clearly there were issues of personal responsibility in the story of Angie and Jewel. And clearly, I mean, they dropped out of high school. Mm-hmm. They had children with drug dealers. They chose not to work at various periods of time. Those were decisions they made. They'll say that themselves. I mean, this isn't blaming the victim. This is just reflecting their own mature reflections on their life. Mm. But there's also clearly a lack of opportunity in their lives. So Clinton's conceptual framework of marrying opportunity and responsibility, I thought, was exactly what the country should be doing.
And the reality
of reform. The question is whether the country did it. It very, very imperfectly. But we've just been talking about welfare, right? Which is the check that women get. Here's a story that the poverty reporter for the New York Times largely missed.
That would be you.
That would be me. And this is called it's the expansion of something called the Earned Income Tax Credit.
Right.
Angie, by working, now gets $5,000 a year in wage subsidies through this program called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which most of the public has never heard of. It provides more than welfare used to provide in the average state. It's a huge program. It's bigger than welfare used to be, but it only goes to workers. So by working, it reinforces the value that society has of work. It gives her a crucial boost to her too low wage. Now, is it enough? Does she have a good enough life? Well, absolutely not. But there's been an expansion of that program. There's been an expansion of health care. There's an expansion of child care. All of them inadequate expansions. But I think we've moved at least imperfectly towards this goal that I would like to preserve of, you do your part and we'll do our part.
Jason DePaul, your book and your reporting must excite both parties and drive them both crazy at the same time, because it doesn't really fit into either party's dogma about welfare.
Well, here's a way you can tell Angie's story, right? I could tell you her story that she was on welfare for 12 years, and within 6 months of this law taking effect, she got off the rolls, had a full-time job, got a car, got a second job, and got a 401k. And you'd be thinking, you'd be in the hallelujah choir,
Newt Gingrich,
right?
Say, is dancing.
Man. You would think her kids just had a great future. Or I could tell you the same story that said she left welfare and her boyfriend tried to shoot her, and there was a stabbing in her house and a murder in her house, and her teenage daughter got pregnant and dropped out of ninth grade, and then her second son dropped out of ninth grade, and the kids went hungry. And both of those things are true. I mean, both of those things are true, and we need to have both images in mind, which is that, yes, she achieved some things, and the country achieved some things by at least putting some supports in place, minimal as they are for working families. But, God, you have to, you know, continue in mind, we haven't solved the problem by any means.
Joy is calling from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Hi, Joy. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a cousin who was who had three kids with a woman, and she kept refusing to marry him. He had a good job, but she didn't want to marry him because she would lose her welfare. And to me, I mean, it used to irritate me because I've worked three jobs at a time sometimes just to make ends meet. Mm. And she just, you know, she figured she was going to lose her welfare if she was going to marry him. So they lived together. He had his good income. You know, he had a good job. And she kept collecting the welfare. And I think there's a lot of people that take advantage of the system, too.
But, of course, the system's been changed quite a lot, it sounds to me, since then, Joy. But you're still living in horror of welfare abuse.
Yes. Technically, yeah. That's the best way to describe it.
Got it. Joy, thanks for calling. Jason, you know, this kind of story informed a tremendous amount of the energy behind welfare reform. You know, you said there were personal responsibilities in the stories that you looked at. How widespread the sort of exploitive attitude toward welfare before, and is that gone now?
Well, almost everyone who was on welfare cheated. So you could say, yeah, the country was full of welfare cheats, but most of them cheated by working. So you could also say that people were working to support their families. Mm-hmm. The problem was welfare didn't pay enough to live on. So it gave people too little to survive, and then it despised them for taking it. They had to make other plans. You know, it was a degrading system for the people on it. It was a degrading system for the people who administered it, and it was a system that enraged taxpayers. So it's nothing, in my opinion, to be too nostalgic for. Most women had a three-legged stool that they rested on, which was welfare, which we're just talking about cash, but you know, cash and food stamps.
Right.
That was one leg. Some help from a man, and a sporadic under the table job that you didn't tell your caseworker about, and you needed all that in order to get by.
Jason,
that's how you survive.
We've got just a minute left. If you could wave a wand, what further refinements would you make to welfare reform?
Men. This was a reform that was targeted on one gender, the caretaker of the kids, which was almost exclusively women. You know, 90 to 95% of caseloads were headed by women. So there's a tremendous yearning among the kids to connect with their fathers. The women need the economic help from the fathers. The kids need the economic support of the fathers and the emotional support of the fathers. One quick story. Keisha, Angie's daughter, is a terrible student. She winds up enrolling in a crosstown high school, which makes it harder for her to get there because she has asthma. In other words, it's a barrier to her own education because it's got a pre-law program. Why? Because her father is in jail. She hasn't seen him in 10 years. He's been in jail for 10 years, and she wants to become a lawyer and get him out.
I mean, how do you legislate men in 20 seconds or less? How do you
– well,
is there a policy that can change that?
Sure. I mean, 20 years ago, we didn't think we could move unskilled women like Angie into the labor force. We said, hey, there's no jobs for them. They don't have the skills. There's not the child care. And, you know, we experimented and we stumbled, and eventually we moved them into the workforce in large numbers. So is it going to happen tomorrow? No, but gosh, we should take the example that we have of the at least beginnings of success in employing women and say, well, let's do it for the dads.
Jason DePaul, we thank you for your reporting and your time and the insights that only come with that time. It's a terrific book, and thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Jason DePaul, author of American Dream, 3 Women, 10 Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. It's quite a story. You can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay on the hot seat over ethics questions. This is On Point. Yesterday, a Texas grand jury indicted three top fundraising associates of Congressman Tom DeLay, the GOP's House Majority Leader, on charges including raising illegal corporate contributions and directing them to state candidates in 2002 elections. On Monday, DeLay had appeared to have avoided a House Ethics Committee investigation. Yesterday's indictments prompted new calls for the committee to step up its examination of DeLay's fundraising tactics. Joining me now from Austin, Texas, is Jake Bernstein, executive editor of the Texas Observer. Jake, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So tell us what was going on in Texas, at least, what is the grand jury thinking may have gone on that's got Tom DeLay's associates in so much trouble?
What the grand jury is looking at is the 2002 election. What happened was there was a coordinated campaign to funnel, or it appears there was a coordinated campaign to funnel massive amounts of corporate cash to elect certain hand-picked Republicans for the legislature. And the end goal of this was to create a legislature that would be compliant enough to pass congressional redistricting, which they did in 2003.
And this was money funneled to something called Texans for a Republican Majority. It had Sears Roebuck and Cracker Barrel and other corporations behind it. You're saying it worked?
Oh, it worked perfectly. Yeah, I mean they won. They targeted 20 races and they won 16 of them, I think. So it was very effective. And it wasn't just this organization. I mean, there were a number of other players in this that are also being looked at by the grand jury right now.
And the illegality was the way in which the corporations contributed, or the amount that they contributed?
Well, it's almost been 100 years that there's been a law on the books in Texas that you cannot spend corporate or union funds for electioneering, you know, to directly to elect candidates for political office. And this was passed during the age of the robber barons, when the populace were upset that the elections were being run and basically bought by big corporations. So they passed this law. It's been on the books for 100 years, and it appears, at least what these indictments say, is that there was an effort to circumvent that.
You know, critics have been throwing stones at Tom DeLay's fundraising history for a long time. How close are these indicted individuals to the House Majority Leader?
Well, they're quite close to him. I mean, it's important to say that Tom DeLay has not been subpoenaed to appear before this grand jury, nor has he been a witness yet. But three of the people that were indicted are quite close to DeLay, two of them particularly so. One heads up his main national fundraising organization called Americans for Republican Majority, and the other one is his chief corporate fundraiser in Washington, D.C., and the grand jury is looking at an organization that was founded by Tom DeLay, so it's quite close.
We've just got half a minute here, Jake, but you know, of course, that there's been a kind of ongoing inquiry in Washington around Tom's DeLay from the Ethics Committee there. There was an expectation just a couple of days ago that he may have dodged a bullet. Is he in trouble again himself because of these indictments down in Texas?
Well, certainly I think this has given more fuel to the people in D.C. who are demanding that the Ethics Committee actually really look into this stuff and explore it and investigate it in the way that they should. I think it puts more pressure on that. It's unclear whether Tom DeLay will end up being a focus of this grand jury or will be indicted himself. It's just too early to tell.
Well, we'll be watching. Jake Bernstein in Austin, Texas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Executive editor of the Texas Observer. Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.